everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today is May 19th, 2015. I have a really awesome interview today coming forth with Sheldon Neidel. But before we get into that, I just wanted to remind everybody, if you're new to GalacticConnection.com, please check out our daily blog. It runs 365 days a year. It's free to the public, and we really do try to present information that is showing you the progress that's being made on the planet and also increasing your awareness. So please check that out. It's at the top of the menu. There's a daily blog tab, or you can go to galacticconnection.com/daily-blog. We also are extremely well known for our renowned implant removal process. It's one of a kind. It includes not only Jerry's incredible healing abilities, but my alchemy as well. So go ahead and check that out. We've got all kinds of new things coming out, and I will be making some announcements very soon. In the meantime, please also check out a message that I just put up there a couple days ago. It's very imperative that everybody read that. So with that said, you guys know how I am. I'm going to dive right into the interview. For anyone who doesn't know Sheldon Neidel, which would be surprising, he was born in New York City and had his first extraterrestrial and UFO experience shortly after birth, and also experienced contact through various modes of communication, such as light form communications, extraterrestrial visitations, teaching and learning sessions on board spacecrafts. And through most of his life, he really enjoyed ongoing telepathic communications and direct core knowledge inserts, etheric and physical implants. Now, this is interesting. Sheldon has visually observed and physically experienced spacecraft throughout the years. And around the age of 14, something really changed. He was requested that the Sirians and the Galactic Federation of Light Allies discontinue communicating with him because he was so overwhelmed and in conflict between the scientific knowledge and what he was learning on Earth. And they did leave him, but the Sirians and the Galactic Federation told him that they would be back. And obviously, they have come back, and he is spreading all of that information, all of the wisdom that they share with him, he is sharing with the world. If you are not aware, Sheldon has a weekly update, and you can reach his website at paoweb.com, and you'll be able to access his updates and all of his galactic events, as well as he has webinars on a regular basis, which I highly recommend you check out. Today, what we're going to do, Sheldon and I decided that we felt this was very appropriate for the timing of what's going on the planet, is to review his DVD called Journey to Joy, Our Ascent to the Fifth Dimension. And I'm telling you guys, this is a meaty DVD. I highly recommend you purchase it. They're only $26, and it's going to a really good cause. So today we're going to go ahead and go over some of the details of that and hopefully give you some assistance in a really meaty quantum physics subject. So hello, Sheldon. Thanks for your patience.
Sure. Sure. We've gone through a lot that people won't know about yet, but yes, we are patient.
Yes. Yeah, folks, we already had interference and dropped calls and, I mean, you know, typical stuff, just another day for me. But one of the things that Sheldon has actually said to me before is he's so passionate about assisting us in knowing where we came from, where we're going, and why do we need to go through all these changes. And so with that said, I kind of want to start out just with that, Sheldon. Where are we going?
Well, we are going to being fully conscious beings, which you can either call, as they have had me use, galactic humans or physical angels. And what we are, we're going back into our divine service to be helpful in basically maintaining suns and the planets that we're on. And the planets that we're on, the inhabitable ones, they are basically used, even physical angels on them, to be part of the spiritual hierarchy and to maintain the planet, the ecosystem, etc.
Wow. Gee, no small feat there.
No. We are incredible beings, all of us, and we are on a journey to becoming who we once were, and that's why I look at this time as being probably the most exciting journey that humanity has ever gone through.
It really is. I can't agree with you more. And one of the most beautiful things I loved at the beginning of your DVD was talking about the correlation and the connection between divine joy, divine love, and divine light. Can you go over that with us?
Sure. Well, we have to remember, as we look at this, the basis of creation in the universe is divine love. Out of divine love comes divine light. Light is that instrument which is used by divine love to create all things. And when we get into our reality, what we find out is that light and love have come together to produce matter. And matter then can be sculpted because we then have space. And of course, space is really energy. Everything within us, even though people say, oh, 92% of us is space, that no, 92% of us is really, in our physical body, is really what I would call, what some people use in the physical world as zero-point energy. I call it space energy or just creation energy. And that's what we really are. We're really a hologram. And this divine light is in that 92%, and it's orchestrating what's happening in the other 8%. So we are actually a divine hologram. And what we're doing with becoming fully conscious is we're going to be given the key to how our own particular hologram operates so that we can do all kinds of amazing things. Because remember, the capabilities that we have is infinite. Once we understand exactly how it operates, it's kind of like if you look at a computer, it's kind of like getting the access codes to the machine. So that's what we are about to get and become fully conscious beings.
Wow, I love that description. And in fact, you know, hologram is a word that is really tossed around a lot on the internet. And I felt like your description was very intriguing. You were talking about how reality holograms are special interdimensional light. And I was wondering, how does the matrix fit into that equation?
Well, you're talking about the beginning of each reality has a basic grid. Because what has happened is the interdimensional prism set up by the divine love has taken this light, has made it unidirectional, and has created its own special level of how in that particular dimension reality we operate. What's in there, what's not in there. Well, if you look at the framework, each framework contains a matrix. What has happened is those beings who were given a reality over us, first the Atlanteans, and then heaven for a limited time allowing the Anunnaki, which are the space gods and goddesses, quote unquote, they for a time had the ability to interact with this. Heaven told them that the basic aspects of the access codes were not to be touched because at a certain time, this whole thing, which is our physical selves, was going to be completely changed back into what we once were, which is fully conscious beings. That's what's happening right now. The Anunnaki and the Incharns, who were the dark energy, the dark continuum in this particular galaxy, went forth and said in the mid-90s that the time for change has occurred. They created peace because there had been galactic wars in this particular realm of ours for millions of years, and this is now ended. So what we're having now is this shift, and the last major chunk of this shift, which is why the dark group is so anxious to see what's going on here, is that we are now being changed. And Earth has always been sacred place because the singularity that created this entire galaxy. And if you go into the DVD, I'll explain to you how the two basic aspects that are a part of how all matter is created on a large scale are fractals, which were discovered in the last few decades, and vortexes. And vortex physics has, with quantum mechanics, created aspects of how all of this operates. And if you look at it and you understand by going through the simple terms of, as one physicist said to me once, the key is not to get involved in all the mathematics. The mathematics is just there to kind of have you stumble, because like with Einstein's use of an advanced form of calculus, at the time of his death, there were only 12 people on the whole planet who fully understood what that calculus was about.
Wow.
The key is not to get lost in that mathematics and shake your head and say, I can't figure this out. The idea is to look at the simple terminology and use that to understand it, because that's what's really important. And so we have to really understand, okay, let's use simple mathematics. We don't have to use advanced integral and differential calculus, or even, as Einstein did, tensor calculus. What we need to do is to understand simply that there are principles involved in that, and that these principles need to be used and discovered. And that's what I was doing with I guess, most of what was in Journey to Joy.
I also think, you know, a lot of people still have a difficult time maybe wrapping their head around grids, you know, because I think most people realize that everything is made of light.
Right.
But I like the way that you described how the light actually creates the grids. And
right.
I was wondering if you could maybe get into, you know, you were talking about the out-breath. I thought that was very interesting.
What we have to really realize when we thoroughly get into the whole process of how these grids are created, we have to understand, as I was just talking about, there is a divine light, and that divine light comes from the divine love of the Creator. As this light moves through the dimensional levels, it creates these grids and realities. So what happens is the love creates these prisms. I like to call them interdimensional light prisms. And what they do is they take a shape and they create it. And they create, first of all, this, what I like to call, ethereal pattern, which is the framework, which is the matrix. And then they go deeper into the densities and they start creating stuff that we know, like suns and stars, and of course us. And as you see all of this, you begin to see that there are frequencies and there's all kinds of things, like I talked about the nature of convergence and et cetera. But you need to just go through simple definitions of it and take it point by point. First point, every reality has a set group of frequencies. These frequencies converge. That means they coalesce with one another. And then out of this coalescence comes how different things are formed. What is the levels of energy within these frequencies that it's allowed to have? And so as these energies are created and they create these frequencies, you find out that the Earth has a set frequency, we have a set frequency. Lions and tigers, for instance, on this planet, or elephants or dolphins or whatever, they have a set frequency. So what has happened is, as it came down, it classified in each reality what the basic aspects were to be within this reality. In other words, the access codes are the matrix, and then from the access codes, we create the frequencies that create all things. And that's basically what happens without getting into it, because I can't show people the different charts so that people can understand it. Because I think without a picture, even though you create it as simply as possible, it probably still seems a little confusing to people.
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely a meaty DVD, but I learned a couple of things that were just really important for my realization of how the planets were formed, how they coexist with one another. You know, to go back for a second, I thought you described divine love very simply. Can you go over that again?
Sure. Divine love is the essence energy. I'll just use a little different term. It's the essence energy. It's that which makes all things. And out of it comes light. It's kind of like light is the pattern that forms because of the love. So the love mixes with it, with itself, and creates the light. And the light, love and light, then creates space, in our other words, dimensions. Out of these spaces comes matter. Out of this matter comes all of us, everything. Look around you, you see buildings, you see atmosphere, you see the planet, you look at night and you see the stars twinkling. That's all part of that process.
And you define it so simply. And think about it, folks. Divine love makes all things. It really does give you a different concept about what love truly is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're looking at it through more of this lens rather than more of a romanticized, you know, point of view. So now you did talk a lot about prisms and mirrors. Now, is that because this is basically a pyramidal dimension?
No, what happens is in between each dimension in reality, there is a flux space. This flux space has within it naturally occurring prisms, like materials or mirrors, because what we're doing is we're creating out of this divine love, we're creating this divine light. This interdimensional light then has to pass through a medium in order to shift. Mm-hmm. And that's what this flux is doing. We could go into ships and talk about how fluxes are used to go from one reality to another, which is why you can, if you know exactly how the vibrational patterns operate, you can go from Earth to, let's say, Sirius in about 7 minutes.
Wow. Wow. So that puts space-time in a whole new concept.
Right. People don't, when they talk to this physics, they don't talk about the flux. They discount it. Fluxes are the border, or the, you might call them the supernumerary borders that are between all these realities and dimensions. Because within each dimension, there's an endless or nearly infinite set of realities. And we are in a certain limited conscious reality, so we have around us, which is why we can look through the mirror of our reality, and we can actually see all the other realities, and they together form a picture of what we like to call the 3D world around us. This is what physics is looking at. And physics is, astrophysics is so amazing that 96% of everything they call either dark matter or dark energy, and that's the stuff that makes us. So actually, we're talking with all our theorems and whatever you want to call them, they're definitely not laws. And the concept of physics with the speed of light is definitely wrong.
Wow.
You can go to these flux spaces, and when you go in there, the laws of physics as we know them do not exist. And all we're talking about is just like 6% of reality. That's all. You wouldn't call something a science if it could only see 6% of reality. But that's what they do, and they have these laws. Understand that once you break through in, by raising your frequencies in a proper way into these fluxes, if you want to go warp 200, you can do it like that. So if there's no law of universal law of speed of light.
You know, I heard that too, Sheldon, that there's just so many laws that we've been taught through quantum physics that are really being negated. And, you know, before I say anything else, I just want everyone to notice that there's this huge siren going by and went on for what, a couple of minutes, Sheldon, while you're talking. We have had so many interruptions for this interview. So
that's amazing.
Everybody pay attention because there's things that are going to come from this interview that obviously someone doesn't want us to talk about. So now, how do the platonic solids come into play with this?
Well, the five major platonic solids are when the early mathematicians, in this case Greeks, looked at it, they came up with the concepts of what I call the basic laws of geometry. And of course, geometry simply means to measure the Earth. And so they were looking at what are the shapes, what are the conditions of certain basic ways you look at things? They really didn't have advanced formulas. No, they were just using A plus B equals C. You know, they were not doing fancy stuff. They weren't putting in all these limitation things and everything else that you have in calculus. They were just looking at the world and trying to see, well, how does a triangle operate? How does that relate to everything else? And so they came up with these basic solids, which to them were the stable aspects of geometry. And then they based all the other stuff that they learned, all the different theorems, et cetera, on the nature of these solids. And, of course, that is the basis. If you look at how they figured it out, this is also the basis of what's called sacred geometry. And you find it in all different kinds of pyramids and in how balls are measured and cones, et cetera, which are part of the solids. So you discover quickly, you see how their math worked. And of course, they had one guy in ancient Greece who measured within a few hundred miles the circumference of the Earth.
Wow.
And all they knew was Greece and the Mediterranean.
Isn't that interesting? Well, now you also spoke about the grids having rules.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting. Could you go over that a little bit?
Sure. every grid that creates a reality within it is set up by either the strongest, most conscious force that's going to occupy it, and by the various administrations of heaven. And they decide this particular matrix is set up for being able to do this and that and this and that. So they outline it. And so everything that is born, and I'll use the quotes with that, within that framework of that particular grid, operates according to how it works. And even modern physics has come up with this concept of physics and pre-physics. They realize everything within a set reality has limitations. In other words, what it can do and what it can't do. Now, when you get to a fully conscious grid, those limitations are vast. So they're virtually erased. Huh. Because when you become fully conscious, you can do amazing, incredible things. So what is needed then is for us to really realize, well, that this grid is, it's like a boundary for the energies within it to perform how they wish to do so. In other words, what do they set up, a life contract, et cetera, and play it out with each other. And that's what this is all about. But when you have fully conscious grids, you can go from one grid to another grid to another grid. You understand how this operates. You're one with heaven. You're one with the great creator. And, of course, the ultimate level of love is joy. As a matter of fact, in Syrian, the word for God is Jata, which means the joy of heaven.
I know, that's so pretty. And, well, now, when you say going from one grid to another grid to another grid, isn't that kind of the same as, like, astral travel or space travel?
It's similar to it, yes.
And also, I was wondering, when you're talking about getting to a higher state of consciousness where you have far less limitations, can you describe, what could we not do once we reach a fully galactic, full consciousness status?
The question almost is, what can't we do? We can do practically everything.
Wow. So we can walk through walls. We can travel from here to Jupiter in milliseconds kind of thing, right?
Right, right. You can change your shape. You can make yourself bigger or taller. You can change whether you want to be male or female. You can change the entire concept of how you want to live your life, provided it's within the life contract. One of the things that happens before everybody is born is you go with your councils, you go with the highest levels of administration that are part of what you're doing as part of your life stream. You come together and you work out how you're going to do this life contract. Who do you want to meet, et cetera, what kind of energy, and that represents certain kinds of energies. You go through the whole thing. In the case of Assyrian, it's 3,000 years of earth years. And so you ask yourself, what is it that I want to do? So one of the things that the Syrians did, and they taught me when I was on the ships, was very simply, you learn that everything in your spiritual existence and the very essence of what your love and joy is what you're taking certain parts of that and you're expanding it out to its maximum level. And then later in another life, you'll take another aspect of that and expand it out to its level. And in doing all of that, you retain the knowledge, because what happens is, their ascension process and rebirth and ascension and rebirth, all the stuff that's happened, whatever it is, what experience, what incident, anything else that you can possibly think of, it's all in there in your Akashic records, and you have complete review of that. You can go into the administrations in heaven, and they will appoint a guardian for you, and you can go through your entire Akashic records, let's say to 100 lifetimes back. Because what you're doing, they consider every life to be in divine service to the universe. Mm-hmm. What can I do? What can I not do to help others? How do I work together collectively to expand the love energies and the light energies within any reality? And also you ask yourself, how do I work successfully during my lifetime to expand the wisdom that I have? How does that wisdom grow? And that's what they're interested in. So their concept is that their currency, and I'll use it only in quotes, is basically love and light. And so they always tell me, the Syrians, especially Washta, always used to tell me when I was a kid, especially, that they saw this Earth society and they considered it to be upside down and backwards, because the last thing you want to do is to do things that are totally against what you want because somebody has created an instrument that it's almost like a Mayan instrument, an illusionary instrument, to force you to do what they want, not what you want to do. And they thought that was ridiculous and upside down and backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I learned about them is they do not have any concept of less than. They see themselves as a great group of incredible beings working together to create a better universe. That's how they look at the world.
Sure, and they're, I mean, they have to be seeing this as an upside down maniacal thing. I mean, look at the way we're set up. First of all, everything practically is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And all that we have been taught goes against the grain of acknowledging our own sovereign birthright and our free will, which is what you're talking about.
Right.
So, well, okay, now talk a little bit about, I thought this was the coolest thing of all. This was a big aha for me. You were talking about the grid creating a divine cross. And, you know, the cross, of course, is in all the ancient archaeology throughout the world. Everybody is mesmerized, if not interested, in the cross. This was a little bit of a different spin for me. So I wanted you to talk about that.
Well, let's, okay, and up to now we've been talking about the grid and the potentials. And the potential is majored in physics and frequencies. And what the cross and a lot of other similar things do is they're expressing the nature of the love and light at that particular frequency. The cross is looked at even in traditional sacred geometry as an attractor. And that's why it's always been related in most ways to heaven, because it's a divine attractor. Mm-hmm. And that's really the important point that I would think would be out of that.
Beautiful. God, I just love that. And then now, I had a little bit of a difficult time when you were talking about the divine light is basically based on two components, the vortices and the fractals. Now,
okay.
The fractals, the vortices I totally get. You know, I saw the, you know, as above, so below. I saw the zero point field and that kind of thing. But are the fractals completely a separate manifestation?
No, they're a part of it.
They're a part of it. Okay.
They're a part of it. If you were to look at fractals, what they are is the same thing being recreated either as bigger or smaller, depending on where it is in the entire workings of how you look at the fractal. The fractal can start out very small, and it reproduces itself again and again, and it gets extremely big. Now, the basis of what we're talking about here, let's look at the vortex. It's kind of like a tornado.
Yeah.
And it spins. Because the spin is the basis of all motion. So if you look at the fractal, the fractals are constantly in motion. Example, of it is all kinds of sacred geometry, and even the Nautilus, most famous example of fractals. You find in every leaf, you find in everything, fractals. Fractals are in motion. We can't see that motion, but it's there. So the fractals are reproducing all that the vortexes create. So the vortexes create the fractals keep reproducing.
Ah, okay, now I get it. That's a lot clearer for me.
That's why sacred geometry is all about these numbers, pi and phi.
Ah, okay.
And if you look at all of that, you begin to see all the concepts of the ancient Greeks, which is about prime numbers, etc. This is, all these prime number things are how they create their fractal systems. What the Greeks were doing, and other civilizations were reproducing, they were doing the same thing in India and the sacred aspects of Egypt and China, and also in the New World. What they were doing was showing how creation happens. And of course, they would be using what seemed like strange religious terms, because they didn't have the preciseness or the wisdom to understand it other than through this mirror of theirs, or this window of theirs, that said everything you look at and you create has to be according to this religious symbology that you have. And so they attempted to try to tie both of them together. And the result is sometimes, if you look at it, different religions, it's of the ancient world gets pretty confusing. So I understand why people would be confused.
But, you know, you've done a great job, tackling a very scientifically oriented topic and making it a little bit easier for those that are not so scientific to understand. So I thank you for that. Now, how do spheres play into this?
Okay, spheres is the perfect balance. The circle is the symbol of balance. And, of course, what happened is the ancient geomancers understood that the original orbit of the Earth took 360 days to orbit the Sun.
Okay.
So that's the perfect circle. So the perfect circle is 360. And that's why.
Everything's so logical. You know, when you talk about it, it just seems so simple. Wow. Well, you know, this is kind of a side question, but you were saying that everything is based on spheres, and I remember the last time I interviewed you, I asked you about the flat Earth. One of the questions I wanted to ask you was, why does all the water always find a flat surface, no matter how big of an area it is?
Because it has surface tensions. So it appears flat, like a mirror. Like if you look at a lake,
okay,
and it's a small lake, it's not a big lake that constantly has currents in it. There's no waves. But even then you'll notice how everything in the water, even the waves, tend to be, whether they're cycles of one wave or another, are exactly the same, which is why a wave, when you see it coming in, you look across, it looks the same. It's curling in at all the same time.
True.
What's happening is there's surface tension on the water. So it appears flat, but it's not. It's on a curved surface. What we have to realize is if you look at the horizon line, you look at the horizon going on, it curves down. Now, once again, medieval religion, Christian religion of that time in Europe, thought that the natural curve of the Earth meant it was going someplace else. And this was, the Mayans said the same thing, they called the world beneath this horizon line the Dark Land. And they have all different names for it.
Huh.
But we have to remember, and this is one of the most important things for people to understand, the Anunnaki wanted to create the image in humanity, limited conscious humanity, of fear. And the greatest fear of all was the dark world. It's going to come out and get you. It's like the beginning of the first horror movie.
Yeah.
So what happens is this fear then allows them to control you. But what we have to really understand is the Earth is curved. And when you go out in space and you see the planet, you see the curvature. And you can actually go where night becomes day and go to that curvature line. And you can see the planet is not going under into another place. It's just spinning around in its own version of its very, very strange circle. This planet has been compacted and decreased in size. So the result is it looks very, very different to people on the property, in other words, down here on the land, versus those people up there in orbit. And I can understand where all this flat Earth stuff comes from, but I just don't believe in it. And if you've ever been in space as I have been, and you look down and you see the planet from a distance, other words, from like the orbit of Jupiter, and it's this unbelievably small thing, but it's going around in a circle.
Yeah.
And I just don't believe it. That's all. I understand where people could come up with those ideas, because there are various concepts of anomalies with this that you can create. But I've always said, once you go into space, you see what an anomaly this concept of flatness is. So I just, and of course, I know the flat Earth was so powerful in the 15th and 16th century because of certain papal bulls, in other words, agreements,
mm-hmm,
that people were afraid of it. Copernicus didn't write his story of a curved Earth until, as he told his son, you do not publish this until I am dead and buried.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it wasn't very easy to rock the boat back in those days, was it?
No, it wasn't. You mean you got tremendously tortured, and then in all that pain, they would then allow you to die in something even more painful, like getting burned to death.
Yeah.
So naturally, Copernicus said to his family, "You do not publish my papers until I'm dead and buried."
Yes. So the other thing I thought was really interesting is you were talking about how Mother Earth has electromagnetic life energies, and mm-hmm. therefore that which lives on her or with her must have the same.
Right. Well, while we're talking about planets, stars, and other heavenly objects are electrogravitic, and electromagnetic are animals like ourselves and everything else that lives on the surfaces. Of course, we will be able to change the nature of our now dipole electromagnetic reality when we become fully conscious. So, because we've basically been lowered to a just above animalistic level of existence.
Wow. When you say that, that's really sad. When you say it that way.
It is very sad. It is very sad. When I was up with the Syrians, you could see the difference. Like you said, they could go through walls. Once they gave me a little pin that would allow me to actually do that. And let me say, it was a weird feeling. It feels like somebody's putting an ice cube down your back when you go through a wall.
Wow. I can't wait. I mean, just to be able to walk into a mountain, you know, look inside the planet, those things. I mean, that would be very, very cool. Well, the reason I ask about that is I know you said that there was a relationship between the electromagnetic versus the electrogravitic.
Right.
Now, does that apply to, I mean, is that just within our solar system? Because you said that each grid has its own set of rules, and I was wondering if other solar systems or galaxies don't have that same kind of...
Well, we have immediately clustered around us similar realities, similar frequencies, similar rule frequencies.
Okay.
And that's what we see when we look out in the sky. Those that are of a higher frequency... That's why you have these great voids when you look at the stars.
Mm.
And as astrophysicists can tell you, those seemingly looks like small, great voids to us are millions of light years. So there's a lot of space in a light year. Think of what a light going at 186,000 miles per second.
Wow.
For one light year, that's 6 trillion miles. I mean, that's a distance.
Well, how do you feel about that, you know, as far as, is there really miles?
I really look at it as a different way, because we're looking and attempting to create a body of knowledge within the energies that we created. And, of course, the energies that we created in physics is simply that Rene Descartes said way back in the 18th century that everything had to be according to lowest common denominator. And that means that the spiritual aspects of science, or what it can measure, has to be hacked away.
Mm.
So that's what science has done. It has always been, like religion, the number one believer that the only thing you can say is real is the physical world around us. Like, you can see a wall, and if you hit it too hard, you can break a bone. But if you hit the air, nothing happens. And so that's what they that's the basic concept of what they want. What you see, truly see, is real. What you can't is not. And science right now is in the process of changing all of that. Quantum mechanics is leading us into a whole new reality of getting rid of Rene Descartes and a lot of the concepts of physics. And when you look at various people like Professor Wheeler, who, when he was doing physics at Ohio State, was able to explain to people that there are different realities. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was the first beginning in quantum physics of looking at the world and seeing that it's not the same homogeneous thing you see around you, but that actually there are realities that can happen.
Yeah.
There are realities that act like a pre-physics, which means all the rules we know don't exist. And, of course, that's most of this world out there beyond our planetary system. And
well,
so as, go ahead.
No, it's not to interrupt you, but isn't it true that so much of our science is based on Einstein's, law of relativity and things like that, which they've completely debunked quite a bit of what he's presented? And
they
so there, you know, my question is, it's like, so most of the scientific community is basically doing postulates and experiments, et cetera, based on these basic rules,
right,
that aren't even necessarily true.
That's correct. And sometimes I think that my big thing when I was a teenager was I wanted to be an astrophysicist. And now I kind of laugh at it. Because what I wanted to do was to take the stuff at Washtahead and take the theorems and postulates and all that that this science has and show how they can be merged together.
Mm.
But when I was taking physics 101 and 102, I wound up with a guy who was the vice chairman of the department who was a Newtonian. And he believed that if Newtonian was his god, and if anybody offended the god, he was almost like King Louis XIV. Throw him out the door, please. And that's what they did with me.
Got it. It's so sad. And I know it's a real uphill battle, because I was going to bring up, once we get to that, Nassim Harriman, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. And I think he's done quite a bit of phenomenal work. When you were talking about the harmonic convergence and you were talking about the harmonic points, which we'll get to in a few minutes, that was one of the questions that I had for you, is do you agree that the planets are actually being dragged by the sun in a spiral pattern?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too. I thought that was just fascinating. Well, okay, now the other thing you talked about, which was cool, was how shapes are created. So is it true that, do I have it clear that just the mere movement in opposite directions is what actually creates a shape?
Right, it does.
I know I got that right.
You did.
Okay. And now what about, you also said that, there's harmonics, which are really, really crucial for the grid and, you know, the actual hologram itself, how everything's
right,
based on harmonics. And my question to you is, they always talk about opposites attract. But what you have been stating is that the atoms attract other atoms of a similar vibration. Can you go over that?
Right. This is a simple thing in physics called convergence. Every piece of matter is vibrating. From the smallest atom to the subatomic particles in the atom, they're vibrating, because basically everything at that small level is energy. So as you understand that, you know that there's a harmonic, because harmonic is something, it's a point. In other words, everything gets up to a certain level and it wants to stop because it's vibrating at exactly the right level that it wants to be at.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the convergence, and so that's why certain atoms of the same type of material are the same as every other type of material similar to that. So that's what convergence simply means. So it's simply know that there are levels that everything has of harmonics. And what they have done with things like cell phones is, instead of using the proper harmonics, they've gone above it. And when you go above something, you destroy it.
Wow.
So what they are doing, basically, is giving us a little instrument that has become the center of communications on the entire planet. And what they are doing is creating at a frequency that's not good for our health. That's why all kinds of warnings about brain cancer and all kinds of other things occurring from this. It's because we're creating disbalances. And they could just as easily use the Selvigio currents, the harmonics, and create it stuff, cell phones, iPads, whatever, and put it at levels that allows our body to feel at a convergence with it, so there would then be a total interaction between the instrument of communications, whatever it is, and ourselves. It would be beneficial because we would then have an instrument that is vibrating at a level that our whole body wants. And this is what they have not done. And of course, go ahead.
Well, sorry about that. That's interesting, too, because if you're talking about the dissonance from the cell phone versus the frequency that our body is vibrating at, have there been any tests where it actually proves the individual's vibration is lowered, or is it just dissonant?
It's just dissonant because there's levels of harmonics in each one of us. They're slightly different. But they're within a field. In other words, if you were to take samples and you were to take a field and look at the whole field and then do the different tests, and you would find out there are certain means within that field that are perfect. And that's where, and that's the stuff that each one of these instruments should have been giving off.
Wow.
And there's a thing called the Salvigio frequencies, and if they would have used those are instrumental things. When you hear them, like whether you can do it with a Tibetan bell, you will see that it totally makes you feel good.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what our stuff, no matter what we're using, whether it's an iPad or a cell phone or whatever, that's the frequencies that they should be giving out. And they knew that way back in the 50s. And they purposely did it at frequencies that create dissonance in our bodies.
That's a shame. And, you know, I use Salvigio frequencies a lot in my alchemy work, Sheldon.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely, you know, you can just totally bliss out just by listening to those sorts of tones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're beautiful.
They are.
And now, the other question I have here is, you were talking about convergence, and then you were talking about amplification.
Right.
Can you clarify amplification versus convergence?
Okay.
Or are they one and the same?
No, they're slightly different.
Okay.
They have a slight difference. Convergence is what we've been talking about.
Right.
Now let's talk about amplification. If you have a singer singing in the same note, and you take another singer and put them next to it that's singing in that same note as well, it'll get louder. That's amplification.
Okay. Okay, cool. Wow. Now, you also dove into how 97% of our RNA and DNA is dormant.
Right.
And I was going to ask you, at this point in time, right here, right now, before becoming a fully conscious human galactic being, what ways do you recommend that we move to a more of a full usage of our RNA and DNA?
Well, first of all, what has been discovered by the Russians and the British and various other groups that are studying DNA right now, they're beginning to see, as they look through their electron microscopes, they're beginning to see that what was originally called junk DNA by Watson and Crick, when they first discovered it, they're now discovering that what's happening within this RNA DNA is it's coming alive. And not only that, but it's encoding. Just like with a computer. You have a computer, and the computer wants to talk to this other computer. It has to encode it. It has to work at the same levels of symbology as that other computer works at. And this bringing together encodes them. This is similar principles now happening with their RNA DNA. So what is therefore occurring is that the so-called junk RNA DNA is actually coming alive, and it's beginning to merge with the RNA DNA, so that a lot of people are now going from a two-strand RNA DNA to a three or four or five. Most of the more advanced young children are being born right now, the crystals, etc. They have two, three, and four, and even five-strand RNA DNA within their bodies. And they have the ability to take that energy, because it's so much more pleasant to us, and utilize it, and that's why they have a natural energy for telepathy. And, of course, what happens is when children start talking to other children, they are doing the same encodement with one another and training their brain cycles so they can talk with one another. And what they do is they do the same thing with their parents, and it comes out in the parent's mind is a loud voice, similar to their own. And of course, we can do all kinds of stories about how these wonderful little kids have saved their parents when they're driving around. So
basically, the younger children that are being born with more strands intact, is it kind of like they just didn't have to work as hard as we did, those of us that were born, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago? We have to work a little harder to get those actual strands activated, whereas they are born right out the gate with those strands activated?
Exactly, because they are supposed to be, when they are older, in their teens, et cetera, instead of just being two-month olders or something like that, they're meant to be the leaders in this society. So what we have are groups that when these little kids are changed in the crystal light chamber, they can move their codes very easily into a young adulthood and become leaders, because that's what they came here for. And of course, the minute they get fully conscious, all the stuff that's in their life contract, whatever incidents, et cetera, it just starts to happen. They get into contact, and what they are going to be doing is being counselors to all different peoples. And they know that their divine service will be to spend an initial time counseling not only their parents, but people around them whose basic purpose is to learn. In other words, they understand their job is to be a teacher at a certain time. And they know that at a certain time that will happen. And therefore, a lot of them look at this present world and they just ignore it. And people are wondering, why don't they care? Because they know it's going away and they would rather get on with it instead of listening to all this stuff on the news every day.
It's kind of like out of the mouth of babes will come all the wisdom.
Exactly.
You know? Now, Sheldon, do you agree that because of this ascension process that we're going through, do you agree that a lot of us that are older are actually becoming younger and have the ability to live out a much longer life still?
We do. But once we get the landings and once we get to the point where they can get the light chambers on us and change us immediately into our fully conscious selves, we youth anyways. Mm. The average person, from all that I've seen of the Syrians, they all look like they're between 18 and 22. Every one of them. The guy says, I'm 2,000 years old. And you go, what?
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Is that going to make everybody's day or what? So you also talked a lot about the positive and negative spin of you know, matter and how everything comes out at a point. And the question I had for you is, isn't the point, which you also refer to, I think, as the singularity, is mm-hmm. that not also the same as zero-point field?
It is.
Okay.
The greatest misnomer in the entire history of physics, as far as I'm concerned.
Really?
When I was doing this research, I called it space energy. But anyway, I don't really understand zero-point means the point of minimum or absolute lack of motion. It's like zero Kelvin, you know? So mm-hmm. I look at this and I say, that isn't what's happening. All that's happening is when it comes to a certain point, it diverges into everything else. It's like you have a point and it's like the nozzle of a hose, and the water reaches that point and then it just spreads out.
Wow.
And that's what's happening here. So I didn't really see this as that, because when I had the devices, I learned that there's a point in which all of this energy fields converge. And if you touch that energy field, it won't kill you. You know, it may be 10,000 volts and 500 amperes, which according to the laws of physics as we know it today should fry you. It doesn't. It just throws you across the room like you got picked up by one of these characters in one of these action movies and thrown across the room.
Well, now how does that apply to a black hole? Are they kind of one and the same?
Nope. Physics understands at least something. Black holes, the reason why it's black is because it's a void, because it's going to a higher level. When it's coming from the higher level down, it's not a black hole, it's a white hole.
Oh.
And if it's doing both at the same time, it's gray.
Whoa. Okay, so if it's gray, is that similar to zero point?
Somewhat, somewhat.
Okay.
Because it's like you're in a rubber band. You're getting pulled to a certain level and bounced back to the original point.
Wow. But the point with zero point is you're saying it's going from a point of singularity to just basically going everywhere.
Going everywhere, yes.
Which is similar to the quantum field where all things are possible.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Okay, cool. Okay, now you also talked a lot about gravity being like a musical note. I was so fascinated by this part, and I really want you to explain to the world how a low consciousness planet ends up singing versus a higher consciousness planet.
Well, what we have to understand, let's just take gravity on our planet, just an example. You have anomaly points. You have points of high gravity. You have points of low gravity. You have points of no gravity.
Okay.
Or where the energy is so low, it's virtually not measurable. And if you look at that, you look around at the Earth, you see that there are these special modal points for the gravity. And the same thing exists with consciousness. There's points of very little minimal consciousness. There's points of very high or full consciousness. There's points of very limited or low consciousness. All these consciousness points have the ability to transform. And this is something that will happen to our planet. Our planet is going to greatly transform. So what we need to understand then is that these many possibilities, and they are what we're talking about here.
Wow.
I hope that makes people understand it better.
Yeah, and so in the areas where there's low gravity and low consciousness, is that just because there wasn't any light directed to that location?
It's just the nature of how gravity spreads across an imperfect sphere, which is what we have on our planet right now.
Uh-huh.
You know, our planet used to be a perfect sphere. It used to have 360-degree orbit, which applied to 360 days, which is why the traditional year around the world is 360 days, because it represents each degree of the circle. Because it used to go through 1 degree every day, and it would keep going until it got to 360, and it was back at the starting point.
Interesting. And that, folks, would be another good indicator as to why the Gregorian calendar is bunk.
Exactly. Well, first it was made up by a bunch of monks who were trying to put the wool over everybody's eyes. So
unfortunately. So now what is really near and dear to my heart is you also went over our new solar system. I thought this was really cool. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit. You've traveled to all of these various planets, right?
Yeah, I've been around. I was around them. We must remember, though, that Vulcan is in another space right now.
Okay.
When the Italians first discovered it in the middle of the 19th century, almost 200 years ago, it was the 1840s. They discovered Vulcan, and they called it Vulcan because they said, wow, this is the closest planet to the sun. So Vulcan was the god of heat and fire and volcanoes, so they said, we'll call it Vulcan. And even though people get confused because that's also a planet in Star Trek, we have to understand it's a planet, actual planet. It was photographed, its orbit was looked at, it was calculated and all that stuff, and then it disappeared because it had to move to a higher level.
That's amazing.
So that's one, that's the innermost one. And then if you go around, you go to Mercury. And Mercury used to be called, when I was in high school and college, used to be called the most inactive planet. It was actually called the dead world.
Huh.
Guess what's the most volcanic planet in this particular solar system right now?
Mercury?
You got it.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Huh.
So, and also, like everything else I've been talking about with vortexes, Mercury is hollow. Every planet is hollow.
Right.
Right. So when you see the South Pole of Mercury with this picture by a NASA satellite, you know that you're not making it up. It's real.
Yeah, you had some good photos showing the poles at the north and south end of the planet. I think those were incredible that you found those. Now, you know, Sheldon, my question to you is, you know, everybody hears about Venus. Nobody really talks a lot about who's actually living within Venus at this time.
Right, they don't, because the outer planet has all kinds of weird stuff going on with it. With it can be heat explained as, you know, it's basically a super hot house, you know, 700 degrees on the surface, which is very hot. That would not only begin to make us sweat, it would probably create an advanced version of just too hot. Our bodies would overheat tremendously, and we would die from that. Wow. So, but inside the planet, when you look inside where they show you where the interior is, in other words, the vortexes show you that the south and north poles of the planet are hollow, inside there is an entirely different story. Mm. It's actually a lot cooler. All the stuff that exists on the top of the planet doesn't exist. The atmosphere is actually breathable. And so in this special little world inside the planet, we have Venusians. And they are beings very similar to us. And most of them are also etheric, which means they could exist on the surface if they wanted to, but they don't. Hmm. They want to be able to go onto the inside of the planet and basically take care of what's left of the ecosystems of the planet that are living, which are inside, and prepare at the right moment when all this shifts to put together this tremendous world. You know, Venus is practically the size of Earth, and she has basically the same surface as we have when it was pristine. In other words, it had a bunch of really magnificent oceans.
That, you know, and that was really intriguing to me that you said that Venus and Earth were almost identical in size. And you were talking about how Mars was almost like the watchdog, right, so to speak, between...
Well, it's basically a lot smaller. It's like between a quarter and a half of the size of our planet. It's not very big. And it has two little weird burnt remnants of its two moons running around on the outside. And of course on the outside is a system that looks very much like a forever desert with a very low level of atmosphere.
Wow.
So if you look at all of that, it doesn't look too nice.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, Sheldon, you brought up another good point, which is because of the Anchara Alliance and all the destruction from all the previous galactic wars, is it to be assumed that all of these planets would be inhabitable like Earth if that
right.
had not occurred?
They were. That's why you have the anomalies on the surface of Mars, the so-called face of Mars, the pyramids of Sedona, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are actual remnants of what once was a great civilization that existed in the inside of the planet and had various, as all fully conscious groups do, had actual sacred places. And if you look at the location of where these are on the planet, they are at sacred nodes, that these were where they came to maintain the planet and maintain all life on both the surface world and in the inner world.
Wow. So are you saying when you talk about surface world and inner world, are you saying that when we become fully conscious galactic beings where, you know, our consciousness is mirroring our bodies and everything is in balance and, you know, we're basically a microcosm of the planet itself, which is, you know, a macrocosm where they're internally it's in balance just like it is externally. Mm-hmm. Why then does everyone choose to live within the planet?
When you live within the planet, you're in the basis of the spiritual energy of that planet. You are working with the planet's ethos and its spiritual hierarchy to maintain a balance, to maintain ability of that particular system, spiritual, etc., that is the basis of what Mars or Venus or Earth is all about, maintain that energy. So as that energy works, it then spreads across not only the inner planet, but across the surface. And one of the things that we have discovered ourselves, people studying whales and dolphins, they have discovered that what they do is create the energies that allow every spring in the north and every equivalent of every spring in the south, which would be our fall, they actually bring life back every time.
Oh, my God. I know. You know, I remember that I actually started crying when I just love the whales and dolphins. Now, you did also, this is another question I have for you. You mentioned that each of the planets is going to have kind of its own purpose, its own role. And
Right. You
talked about Mars being the science center, and you talked about Venus being like the vacation and healing area.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true for all solar systems? Do they tend to set up that kind of setup?
They tend to do that. Like, for instance, in Sirius, there's one planet that's the main one for everything that goes on within that particular star nation. There's another planet a little bit farther out, which is more deserty, and it's more of a extra planet. In other words, it's where you go for recreation, because while it's a little bit hot on the outside than normal, on the inside, there is the equivalent of oceans and everything else. So it's kind of like a rec center area. So you have the working planet and the other planet, after these two. And one of the things that this happened to me when I was first starting out, this was about 92. And so I was with a friend, and he was going across in Washington, and we stopped at this city, I forgot the name of it. And this friend of his, who was the former wife of this healing guy who had died, and he had gotten this beautifully, it was almost like a lead sculpture, and it had these major planets and the central sun and everything. And so I saw it the first time, and I just started crying, and they wondered why. Mm-hmm. But they said, that's the same reaction that he had. As a matter of fact, when he saw it, he ran to his bank as quick as he could, because the guy wanted it in cash, and came back with the money.
Wow.
And what it is, when you look at it, it's a perfectly made sculpture of the two main inhabited planets of Sirius B, as looking at it from above.
Oh, my.
And it's perfectly done, perfectly done.
God, it must be gorgeous.
It's beautiful. And then, of course, she immediately had to say to me, I don't care how much money you offer me, I'm not letting you buy it.
Yeah,
it
no
stays
kidding.
Here in this room.
I bet. I was also intrigued by you calling Earth the new conference center. Can you talk a little bit about how that is going to play?
Well, what's going to happen is there right now exists between the Agarthans and the Federation a large amount of interaction. And what they want to do is convert their main base the Federation built into a center where people from all across the galaxy, as well as other galaxies, can come and then be able to hold conferences so they can determine what works with creating relationships between not only star nations, but between galaxy to galaxy. And that's one of the big things. And because of the singularity, which when you get fully conscious, you can feel that energy and tremendously, that would be a natural place to gather, because that energy creates a feeling of well-beingness, and they thought that would be perfect. That's why they were looking at our planet when it became fully conscious as being a conference center.
Now, do you see that conference center, and I'm sure it's more than one, of course, but do you see that occurring on the outside of the planet or the inside of the planet?
The inside.
Okay. And just by the way, Sheldon, ever since the accident in 2001, that's constantly the information I've received.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that. You just gave me more confirmation.
Okay.
Okay. So how about Saturn? You know, I mean, everybody looks at Saturn as Satan and, you know, the black box location where all the real nasty, dark, people, or I don't even want to call them people, but beings hang out and do their black magic ceremonies, etc. Well, how is Saturn going to play a role in this?
Well, Saturn, like Jupiter, is really the closest in of the so-called giants, the giant gas giants that, like, if you were to look at the size of Saturn and look at the size of Jupiter to our planet, we're like a little marble.
Yeah, big time.
What we have to realize is they convert the energy that's constantly coming in from deep space into more friendly energy, and that more friendly energy then goes into the sun and then comes out to feed all the planets. So what they're doing is they're kind of like a harmonic convergence out there of all this energy.
Wow.
And allowing the sun to then take that energy in and send it out as a more complete set of frequencies that actually helps to make all the planets exist.
Oh my God. So basically the way that it is right now, that's why they focused on Saturn, because it's converting energies coming from deep space.
Right, and it's doing it at a lot lower level, because all the planets in our solar system had to be lowered in frequency, because when we became the only being living on the surface that was totally involved in a very low level, as I just explained before, low level degree of consciousness, you then discover very deeply that all of this energy has a reason for existence. In other words, if they were to send in this high-level energy, it would wipe us out when it came back out through the sun. So they have to convert everything at a lower level. So our entire system has been lowered down from Pluto all the way into the sun. It has to get lowered, because if it wasn't, we couldn't exist in the solar system.
That is so fascinating. Oh, my God. And then you also talked about Uranus returning to its upright position. How would that affect us? Like, what changes would we start noticing by just that alone?
The frequencies coming out of the planet are going to change drastically. So in the old, old texts, way back to the Greek times, Uranus, even when they didn't know it, it was hypothetical back in the ancient Greek times, up to the present, they've seen Uranus as a center for spirituality. So actually, what Uranus will do when it becomes fully conscious again, it will take the energy that's coming in towards Saturn and Jupiter, and it will help further moderate its spiritual essences. So what we have to understand is the gas giants are at the outer end of our solar system, because they are the filters of all the energy coming in to our solar system. And the sun also exists at the levels we can see it, but it also is a multidimensional being, and it takes that energy as well and brings it in. So what we are having, you can look at the sun as kind of like a radio. It has both energies that can't be measured, and it has filtering system that goes out into the solar system. And so you do that and you get to understand it. When I was 10, I had a visitation from the solar people that live inside the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me all kinds of information about all of this. And there's now a theory which is beginning to explain what they were talking about, which is the whole concept of what they call the electrical nature of this universe. And so we have an electrical nature for the sun and everything else that exists in this galaxy and other galaxies. And of course, they have discovered that there's lightning that happens at very low levels. But if you realize that there's an electrical energy and that it's transferring constantly across the universe, and with all the other things that are happening, you can see that indeed there is a constant creation going on within this entire universe. And it's pretty amazing stuff. But of course, we can't measure it at any large levels, because we, with our limited concept that only if it's real can we invent meters for it, we need to start inventing meters, as spiritual science has across the galaxy, and start measuring all these phenomena and understand exactly the true state of how this living universe operates and interacts. Because remember, the whole is like a giant body and it has parts. And so each one of the galaxies is a small infinitesimal part of some basic aspect of what a physical being would need in order to survive. And so you see this, and suddenly all these spirals coming around, the various fractals interacting with that, and you see the energies going back and forth, and suddenly you see an immensity of an incredible pattern. You see that what has been created here by the Creator is an immense, unbelievable, beautiful system. And we need to really understand it in that context and get out of our very limited xenophobia concept of reality. And we really need to do that.
I know. And hey, I just thoroughly enjoyed this because you really gave me a different concept of the solar system just completely. How everything has so much a purpose and that it all fits with the entire organization or cooperation. You know, each one has its own place within the entire system itself.
Right.
Now, one of the other things that I just found mind-blowing, and I had to literally replay it to make sure I heard you, and that was you were talking about Bologna.
Right, that was the original one I had, of course. We have a thing between Mars and Jupiter, which is called the asteroid belt.
Right. And the part that just blew my mind was you said that they went in to destroy it because that was the headquarters of the dark, and they deliberately left the asteroid belt so that they could come back later and create it once again. Can you talk a little bit about that? I was just fascinated.
Okay, everything has, it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle. There's tens of thousands of pieces, and maybe even hundreds of thousands of pieces, because there's so many big rocks and small rocks. Each one of them has a frequency and an energy that converges with another piece. And so when the Elohim and the Federation come in, they can just, using their instruments, can create fields which will quickly allow this now destroyed planet to put itself back together again. You just do it in a nutshell without explaining forever how it's done, because it's a long story. There's six parts to it, and et cetera. I mean, I don't
really
know. Right.
Well, you and I definitely should do that on another interview, because I think that's just, to me, that was like an aha moment to read about that. You also mentioned the face on Mars, and you talked a little bit about it being the original race of Earth. How does that, because it looked a lot like an ape, right? Kind of like
an ape. It looks that way. It looks like, but actually if you look at it and you extrapolate from the shape of it, you see that actually it is a face of a human.
Mm.
And as you get there and you understand that, it's kind of like almost, it looks almost with the hood part over it, it looks almost like a pharaoh.
Yeah, it does.
So as you do this and as you extrapolate and look at all of this, you begin to understand that there once was a ritual city on the surface of this planet, near an ocean.
It's amazing.
And that this was a center. And of course, when the Incharans came in from Orion, they just wiped everything out. But they, because of the nature of these megaliths, they were able to be formed properly. And of course, geology knows that if you look at anything that's worn and you look at it from a distance, you can, your first immediate thing after some research is to say, this is either man-made or natural. You don't know until somebody goes and explores it. And of course, the one thing NASA has done is not try to take pictures of it from the surface, not attempted to take aerials directly over it, not attempted to find out what's in the various bits of sand in between these things, what is real and what is not. Because the last thing that NASA wants is for us to understand this. Because that changes the whole concept of every religion on this planet.
Sure. Absolutely.
And their job is not to not only rock boats, but have the boat hit by a 100-foot tidal wave. But what they want to do, is keep it either or and constantly mess up any above. All the pictures that they do now are a little more, are a little blurred.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying to do is not let anybody really make study of this other than extrapolating possibilities. Because while you do that, there's always a chance you have somebody else with a big fat degree in Martian geology, and they can go forth and explain to you. The easiest thing in the world is to become a doubter of something. So that's what they do. So these guys have to play the skeptic and have to constantly keep that going. But in reality, if you were really allowed to discover and look at these objects, you would discover that these objects are man-made, and in other words, artificial. And once you say there's an artificial object, and of course they have all these theories about, and I use theories in quotes, about how old the Martian surface really is.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk of the oceans as being billions of years ago, which is a bunch of hockey pucky. But anyway,
did you see that photo that was flying around last year where there was actually a chicken walking across the Mars field?
Well, I don't know about any of that stuff, because I need pictures that are not blurred, that are done from the right angles and all that. Otherwise, I don't really believe anything.
Well, and people are actually saying that a lot of the photos that are coming out of Mars were created in the deserts in Sedona, Arizona.
Well, it's the Arizona, well, Sedona with a C-Y and Sedona with an S-E, very similar aspects to the desert.
I know. I just thought that was, you know, very coincidental. So, now, you also said that there were crystal temples all over the earth that would hold up the firmament. And, you know, a lot of us have just started hearing about the so-called firmament in the last, say, 6 months or so. Can you explain to me exactly what the firmament is? And I think what you said is, instead of now having, don't we have three firmaments right now, but we're going to two?
No, we don't have any right now, but we're going to two.
We have no firmaments.
We have no firmaments.
Isn't that interesting?
This planet, when its energy went down to the harmonics where we can live on the surface without getting fried, in other words, dying from the energies, you can actually take somebody and increase the energies up to a certain level, and it will shake every part of his body, and he'll have either massive heart attacks or failures of heart and liver, and he'll die. But what we have to really understand is there is an energy on our world, and there is an energy in Mars, and what they don't want us to know is to know about all of this. And so as I understand more and more of what they're doing, I can see it. You look at how they're trying to hide everything, but it was weird when they did Mercury that they actually allowed for a complete look. In other words, the satellite that was going around Mercury actually took complete pictures of their polar region, so you could see there was an interior of the planet. In other words, Mercury is hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that geology, right away you then say, well, if little Mercury, which is just barely bigger than our moon, is hollow, why isn't stuff like our Earth the same?
Right. Yeah, it definitely blows a lot of holes in the presentation that this is a solid planet, doesn't it? So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, you were talking that the firmament was a layer of frozen water and it actually reflects light. Can you talk a little bit about, well, first of all, if we have no firmament now, how are we functioning without a firmament if having two layers of firmament is the ultimate scenario?
Okay. When the atmosphere opened, in other words, the firmament went away, what happened was during some of the controversy, the wars between various golden ages, the entire firmament collapsed.
Okay.
That's why in ancient Greece and ancient Egypt, they had such incredible astronomy that discovered stuff, in other words, stars and various other objects, easily. Because one of the things the firmament does with those two layers of ice crystals is they're like a telescope.
Ah.
More powerful telescope than the one we've got orbiting around us right now. So they could look up, in other words, let's say you're putting the pyramid together. They could look up and they could see it up there and they could adjust with their geometry exactly how to make it perfect and make it to the true north, true south. So they did that. They could see it.
Hmm.
So as you look through all of that and you see how it operated, it's pretty credible. Now, each layer, one was at about 15,000 to 18,000 feet. The second one's at about 35,000 to 38,000 feet. They're roughly about 20,000 feet across in terms of distance from one another. But each one was a level. If you would take a quarter and turn it on its side and look at it, that's how thick of ice each one of these levels was.
Okay.
Now, what did it do? It filtered out the background radiation appreciably. About 80% of the background radiation would be gone. What does that mean for us? That means we would be much more healthy. That would mean our aging would be maybe one half or less of what it is today.
Wow.
Now, we were tall humans. We were 8 to 10 feet tall in Atlantis. Yet, when the firmament went down, we went from an 8 to 10 foot person all the way down to below 5 feet. And then gradually, in the third golden age, we increased in size. We became adjusted, and we got to a regular size. That's why when you look at ancient Egyptians, you look at ancient Greeks, most of these people were around 5.5 to 5.7.
Okay. Interesting.
And one of the things many people will do if they go to Europe and they look at the ancient knights' armor, they will realize how small they are. But in spite of this, they were very strong. So we lost stature, we lost our length of life, and because we probably were still living between 500 and 1,000 years on this planet's surface with the firmament up. When the firmament left, we went back down to maybe 40 years on average. So that's a tremendous change. And that's what the firmament meant to us.
Wow.
So when this is raised up again, as it will be, as part of the process of the planet increasing its frequencies and its abilities to return to its pristine form that it had long ago, it becomes a different world, a very different world. And when we let after the great changes on the surface, we let it be, we will see a world that is a lot different than what we ever saw. We'll see much bigger trees. I mean, even the redwoods, think how bigger they would get with more oxygen and less radiation.
How exciting. Well, thank you for that. I don't know if I've ever read up on that before, so that's really cool. I'm learning another new tidbit today.
Well, thank you.
Now, you also talked about the grids and how they were obviously, they're turned down, you know, to align with our state of consciousness. How do you see that actually happened? I mean, I think my question is, who, how, when, and was it strictly the dark that did that?
Well, when they created limited conscious beings in the labs at Atlantis about 15,000 years ago, what they created was a being that had to be protected because they knew that outside there was an atmosphere and there was an energy that couldn't be controlled for us, and we would have fried. Now, suddenly, Atlantis goes down, Ionia goes down, Lemuria has already gone down. The Anunnaki, who are now in charge because the Atlanteans left for Centaurus, suddenly they realize they're in charge and they've got to create an outside that works. Mm-hmm. So they have very limited amount of beings, maybe a few thousand spread across the planet that are left, that didn't get killed in the massive flooding that occurred around the planet. So their job, they feel, since they are their charges, is to protect them. And they're protecting them not because of some wonderful opinion. They're doing it because these are the people they want to control, and you can't control anybody if they're dead.
Right.
So they immediately begin doing two things. First, they lower the frequency, and the firmament has died, so they have the radiation, so they let us shrink because there's a certain level where we'll reach a basic balance in this new energy. Our lifespans will go down. But the thing that really freaks us out, and they discover, is death, because remember, we were fully conscious beings. We didn't die. We ascended into some other part of the spiritual realms, and in the spiritual realms, we went with our various guides, and we created a new life, and at a certain time when it was put all together about where we were to go, who our parents were to be, we then came back down. And we came back down as not like a baby that can't remember anything and doesn't have complete control of its body. We would have a degree of control of our bodies, etc. So the whole process, to think of everything you've ever believed in and thought you were, is gone.
Wow.
Think of the shock and the fear that creates.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of the Anunnaki's control of us. So they realized to control us, they needed to use death and fear. So that's what they did, because death suddenly became equal with fear. And so they always promised if something went wrong, they took the fear and turned it into death. And that's how they controlled us. They've controlled us that way for almost 13 millennia.
That's amazing.
So we have to realize, as we look at ourselves and as we see where we're going, we have to realize the degree of inner fear that each of us naturally possesses because of this whole death concept. And that's what they have used. And so when NASA finds there's little crystal units going around in the 15,000 to 18,000 foot level and the 35,000 to 38,000 foot level, and these are the beginnings of the firmament that only come to full fruition when this planet is shifted, they put a little itty bitty article in, and I was able to find, because there were people that were searching for these kind of things, and I was able to get news from them. So I looked at all of that and I saw, wow. And also NASA discovered that there were two position points in the orbit of the moon where they were creating the prerequisites for creating two original natural moons. Because, you know, we lost our moons. Moon 1 went down to destroy Lemuria. Moon 2 went down in the death of Atlantis, because Atlantis was trying to destroy their prodigy sitting over in Ionia. And the Ionians understood this because they were the scientists from Atlantis. And they created a system that turned the moon against itself and landed in Atlantis and destroyed it.
What?
So suddenly both moons are gone. There's no balance without, in this system, in limited conscious reality, without a moon. So they took, now when Pax, or as we're calling it here, Bologna, was suddenly destroyed and created the Astrobel, they took the farthest, which was an artificial moon, and put it out between Mars and Earth. And then, at the appropriate time, the Anunnaki knew they had to bring the moon in, as did the Atlanteans, to maintain the balance. Originally it was to replace the first moon that went. So we had an artificial moon, and we had one, the last natural moon, and then it went, and then everything dropped down, and the Atlanteans left because they couldn't live in a world that was so limited in consciousness. So the result of all of that is now we have this moon up, and we see all these things, these smooth planes and everything, and we don't realize that what is going on with this moon is that, of course, it was blasted because it was a defense system for what most people like to call Maldek right now. But it was the defense system. So it got destroyed. It got blasted. Mm. And though it got blasted, there's still a bit of atmosphere rolling around it. Because at one time, when it was in its original condition, it had oceans, it had land, it had life on it, and it had an atmosphere. But the atmosphere is about 1/6 of what it used to be.
That's interesting, because I read from, I think it was on Project Camelot, somebody came forth and said that they were able to actually walk on the moon without any kind of spacesuit apparatus.
Well, 1/6 an atmosphere is like 20 to 25,000 feet up. It would be very hard without oxygen to do that for any long period of time.
Hey, I'm just passing on the information, Sheldon.
Okay.
That is really interesting. So what is your theory on the dark side of the moon?
Well, both sides of the moon are the same, pretty much. They're a little bit different, that's true. But on the dark side of the moon, because of the weirdness of the orbit of the moon, all kinds of instruments, et cetera, to observe this planet have been there, both from the dark side and from the Federation.
Wow.
And as a matter of fact, what happened on Apollo 13, the true story of Apollo 13, is a lot different than the movie.
Yeah, no kidding. That's for sure. Now, you also said, excuse me, you also said that the stewards of all the planets would be the physical angels.
Right, which are us.
Yeah, which are us. And when you say us, are you referring to everybody that's here? I think that there's a confusion amongst the spiritual community as to what is a starseed who obviously came here from another planet system to assist in this transition versus a human versus a human angel.
We have to understand that we are all basically physical angels. There's two groups. There's those, basically, since we're all ETs, we have to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not from here.
Right.
And if people really study the genetics of humans, they discover pretty much that we're not from here. But the major thing for people to understand is both the group that was originally dropped into limited consciousness, which are the, I call them the original inhabitants, and the star seeds are here for the same purpose, to return the physical essence and soul of that being back to full consciousness. And that's why the star seeds accepted this crazy trip, which would include amnesia and a bunch of other stuff that really isn't nice.
Yeah, no kidding.
As I go through the aging process now, I see what not being very nice is all about.
But don't you feel like you're getting younger?
I feel better, but I really want to be able to do certain programs and policies with some funding that would allow me to, you might say, accelerate the return to I might call it a youthing process. We all need to do that because right now, even the young ones are not in full gradation. They're degrading. We all start to degrade within a year after we're born.
Wow.
We don't realize that. And when you're younger, the degree of stuff in your body that's changing is small. So the changes in the hormones, the changes in the nature of heart health, the changes in the nature of the brain, all that stuff, and even eventually both the growth and then the decline of your sexual aspects, all of that stuff is starting almost when you were born. It's like there's a predetermined aspect that has been set in your genetic code, and that is being used by your body kind of as the massive blueprint for what it's doing.
Wow, how cool. Well, I definitely feel like I'm getting younger. I mean, I'm of course, be difficult not to feel any better from the accident years. but...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's an example of the degradation that happens to the body.
Yeah, but, you know, you had... What you just said was really interesting. I mean, of course, we've carried that degradation genetic code, right, within our DNA.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought you were referring to. Now, another burning question regarding Agartha, okay, and you said that they're overseeing our shift. Now, is Agartha one and the same with Lemuria? I mean, are the Agarthans the leftover, whoever was left over from the Lemurians
right.
way back when?
Way back when, yeah.
Really?
Really. Matter of fact, even their name, Agartha, it's Lemurian for inner earth.
Gee.
Agartha.
That's right. That's right. And is it true that the majority of the Agarthans, they look kind of cat-like?
They look just like us. I don't really see
that's
them
so
as
so weird.
Cat-like.
There's a lot of stuff out there about that, so I was just curious. Now, you also talked a lot about silver and gold, which to me, this was really fascinating. And you were mentioning something about how gold organizes the information and silver gives you the ability of knowing how to use the information.
Right.
How does that play into this whole transition with Mother Earth? And the gold and the silver.
Well, the gold is life. It's what vivifies the body. It's the gold cord, and it comes in through the crown. It goes all the way down to the heart center. And the silver cord comes in through roughly the belly button area and moves in up to the heart. Mm-hmm. And what it does is the silver organizes all that magnificent gold energy that's coming from source in us. And the same thing is going to happen. The Earth has similar energies, although it's an electrogravitic form. So there's a form of oil that is a life energy for the planet. And what helps accelerate and balance this energy is silver and gold deposits. Most of them occur in areas that are very strategic to the different nodes of this planet. So what is happening is, and that's why gold has always been especially big, like the ancient peoples of South America, the ancient Incas, and the civilizations that came before them took gold and looked at it as only to be mined enough to be used to create objects. For instance, the Spanish were amazed that this highly polished gold object that was at the basis of the main temple in Cusco. And, of course, naturally, being greedy types, they took it down and melted it down. But I've heard all kinds of incredible descriptions of this energy. And gold was looked upon as energy of life. The ancient Egyptians understood that. They developed a special form of gold, monatomic gold. And they understood the amount that was needed. And they knew that by doing this, you could actually go to a process very similar to ascension by using this special gold. So, and you could also heal people using this special silver, this monatomic silver. So they understood that gold and silver is part of a life cycle. Of course, naturally, the Anunnaki took it upside down and backwards and turned it into money, because the concept of debt slavery was one of the basic aspects of how they had their societies organized.
Mm. Wow. God, it's just mind-blowing. Now, the other thing that you had mentioned, which I caught this, and it was another one of those ones where I had to go back and play it over again, is you said that the spiritual hierarchy actually is assisting us in activating our DNA. Could you expound upon that? Like, as to how are they doing that? And who are they? And who are they?
There are guardian angels in everybody's body. They are part of different life streams, which we are a part of. What they are doing is they are purifying our RNA DNA, and they're growing it slowly. And, of course, the growth they're doing now in the last few decades is a lot faster. But they're not trying to create confusion, so they're doing it at a level that allows people to become more aware. That's why this worldwide civilization is suddenly becoming more conscious and more aware of what is right and what is wrong. That's why we have Earth Day internationally. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago especially, when the original people involved in the whole process of having people understand about ecology began in the 60s, for instance, they were laughed at. Now look at everything in the world.
Yeah.
All of that is happening because consciousness, and consciousness is tied to the level of shifts in your RNA DNA. So people are waking up at certain times, their patterns shift enough, so they begin wondering about what stuff is real, what stuff isn't real. And so they look at theology, they look at everything, and they look at it in a new light. And as they begin to see certain patterns, a lot of them either become even more religious, or they break away from the religion, and they begin to go out there and become searchers and wandering about within the knowledge and wisdom available to most people on this planet, understanding as they read all of this stuff and as they talk about it with each other, they begin to see there's a body of knowledge which says basically that many of the things that religion talks about isn't correct, that there's a different way of interpreting it. And so we begin to grow large groups of population that suddenly are more enlightened, more understanding of the nature of what's going on around them. And a lot of scientists as well, when scientists in studying quantum mechanics began to understand the very nature of it, there used to be a joke at the at UC Berkeley that they all turned into monks. So as you began to study, you began to look at the world in a lot different way than many people with their Christian background had thought was it, that what was in the Bible was it, and suddenly they're doing physics and achieving things that sound more like Buddhism. So they all started turning into Zen monks of some religious order or another.
Interesting.
They could sit down with a bunch of Zen monks and talk similarly for hours with them. And this is what is happening in this world. The world is waking up, and that is wonderful. But
yeah,
that's part of the process, because you can't have people that are still talking in a way that's centuries ago and be able, if you're a person from space and a high conscious being, that's why for many centuries we've been largely studied and looked at from afar. Now they're saying, okay, heaven has this basic dispensation for you guys. We're here. We're watching you grow. And at a certain time, we're going to come down and finish the process. And so that's what they're doing now. They're just checking us out. They're doing things that help various groups go forth with bringing all those various things that are needed to happen before they can really come down, like producing changes in the monetary and banking system that changes the whole concept of how people look at money, creating new governance that allows many things that were taboo before to suddenly not be blocked. And so what you're seeing right now on this planet is the beginning of this massive quiet revolution.
Yeah, and I also think people forget that they are our families.
Exactly.
You know, we tend to forget that we are a part of them, that they're here to assist us. They're like our brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers, and of course they're going to come and aid us.
Of course. You know? We once were them. We
yeah.
are supposed to again become them, and they know that. They've been told by their heavenly counselors what has to happen, and being people who are in divine service, they are naturally here doing everything that they can within the level of what heaven permits to help the process along.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, Sheldon, this is, in my opinion, one of the more amazing DVDs I've watched in quite a while. And especially because you're taking on such a scientific topic, which someone like myself, when it gets that really deep into the discussion, you know, I can kind of, you know, pull the blinders down a little bit. But I want everyone to know, please check out his DVD. It's called Journey to Joy, Our Ascent to the Fifth Dimension. And it's only $26. And it goes over everything from in the beginning, how the universe was created, how they made planets, how our solar system has transformed, why planets are hollow, the Earth's destiny, the fifth dimensional inner Earth, the greater divine plan, our galaxy, the stewards of the Earth, and back to joy. And I would like to end it with our living our life in joy is bringing up the vibrational rate for the entire planet, right, Sheldon?
Exactly. Perfectly put.
Yeah, so it's important for us to really focus on joy, because he really shows how joy is the very beginning spark to love and light and holograms and grids, etc. So I think you'll really enjoy it. Is there anything else? You know, we have maybe like 3 minutes. Is there anything juicy that you can share with us as far as what you've received lately? I know you put out an update on the 12.
Well, I'm just moving forward what they're telling me about the monetary and banking changes and things that are going to change the world. That's basically what I've been talking about. And one of the things they've told me that I have to do is to kind of be the cheerleader for this whole process of change. So I tell people exactly what they tell me about what is going on and changing in this planet. And we are reaching the end of where this dark cabal that runs our reality right now is fading away and soon will disappear. And so we need to remain positive and work hard within ourselves to maintain a balance, get over this frustration of how this world works. And it has a time frame, and it's slow. And let me tell you, I'm frustrated. I've been trying to wait to get my funding done and get to San Diego for over, God, how long? 2 years?
Yeah.
3 years?
Absolutely. Same with me. And I look forward to you coming down this way so we can do some good work together. It just can't happen soon enough, Sheldon. Now, when you say that they're going to disappear, can you just, before you go, can you just explain how that would be seen by us?
Well, when they disappear, it means that the major parts of them are going to be arrested and separated from
okay.
us.
Okay.
And then the new governances and the new monies and everything can come forth to bring forth prosperity and allow us to begin finally to understand the true nature of this universe. And most of all, at that time, after a certain given point, there will be the Ascended Masters and there will be the landing. So we will then be allowed freely, once again, to get into the wisdom and knowledge that is the basis of the highest levels of humanity. And, of course, that's the Ascended Masters, who are our guides and supervisors and have been for centuries, thousands of years. And also allow the Federation to come down and freely be among us with no problems, and allow their wisdom of their mentors to allow each one of us to get a better understanding of what is real and prepare ourselves for this ascension process. And take what we've, the beginnings of this process that heaven has set up, and actually be able to, with the crystal chambers, to bring us up back to where we were, to full consciousness. And that, to me, it's the ultimate goal of all of this, is to return us to who we are meant to be. And that, to me, is in the Federation, especially among the Syrians, the highest level of love is joy. And so whenever they say hello or goodbye to me, it's always salamat ja, which means be in joy.
Yeah.
And so what I want for this world is to reach that state. The faster, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, absolutely. So, folks, listen, you know, here's the thing. We all have been in this together. We have done a lot of work. If it weren't for us, I mean, I get that message all the time, Sheldon. They could not have done this without the ground crew. They just couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I commend everybody that's listening to this interview for all the hard work you've done, even on an individual internal level. You know, it's very important, every piece that we all provide to this equation. So just don't give up at the final hour. That's what I've been saying that to a lot of people. You know, don't throw the towel in right now, because even though it's gotten a little intense, God, just think of the rewards that we're going to be receiving very shortly. So anyway, thank you, Sheldon. I thank you so much for all your wisdom that you've brought forth to the planet. And if anybody wants to visit his website, it's paoweb.com again. And I just want to thank everyone for listening to GalacticConnection.com, our radio show. It airs on Tuesdays from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Feel free to drop us a line if you have any questions. And as always, we are here to assist you and guide you in whatever way we can. So we love you all. Thanks again for listening, and you guys have a great rest of the week. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks again, Sheldon.
Thank you for having me on again. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay. Salam and ciao.
Bye-bye.